Prevention science can tell us what steps that educators can take to structure classroom environments to support children's executive function and their emotion regulation. Specifically thinking a lot about how you all monitor and know about children's stress and stress physiology, how you tell when kids come into the classroom kind of hepped up and wired because they've had a really intense and scary weekend, or they're kind of laid back and relaxed and happy because they've had a really nice connection with their families, or that they're having good peer relationships. So with that, I'm going to just move ahead. So just to review the idea of self-regulation, we used to have to ask parents for a lot of permission to show videotapes of their kids, and we don't have to do that anymore thanks to YouTube. People put up videotapes of their kids getting into arguments all the time, which is great because I can just pull those videos down and have them available for you so that you can see them. I'm just trying to figure out where the pointer is. Where's the pointer? That's the red thing in the middle. This is an example of executive function. Can I actually do two things, talk and point? Yes, good. Okay, so here are two little girls who are really going at it, right? They are facing what we call a standard emotion regulatory challenge. Why? Because this little girl has her hand around the other girl's neck and is basically trying really hard to get what she wants. And this little girl is doing a fabulous thing, right? She is not only expressing a lot of a negative emotion, but she's making a direct appeal to the person with the video camera, going, "Mommy, mommy, make this other little girl stop," right? So she really captures what we think about in terms of reactivity and regulation, right? Maybe this little girl gets upset more easily, right? My mom used to say that my sister was like a weather system. She was really stormy and she was really intense, whereas I was a little bit more even keeled, a little bit sort of stiller waters, right? Harder to read. So my sister would have been viewed as much more emotionally reactive. But interestingly, she also had phenomenally good regulatory skills. I would hold a grudge for months, right? I would not be able to resolve an emotional issue, whereas my sister could let it go really quickly. She could regulate. She could bring her emotion from very intense right back to zero in a relatively quick way. She didn't have a long latency, basically, to down-regulate. That's what we would, as developmental psychologists, say. She could modulate her emotions easily. So one group of us as researchers really focus on this idea of reactivity and regulation, really focusing on emotion. Another group of us in the field really focus on this idea of inhibitory control. Well, what does that mean, this term inhibitory control? That means basically inhibiting an impulse to do something that is really intense, and using a different, more socially normative and acceptable strategy. So what's the classic example that you all use as teachers?
Use your words.
Thank you. Use your words, not your fists, right? Nice, or your teeth, right, good example. Perfect over here, right? These two little guys are really going hand-to-hand combat. It was over a red car. You can find videos just like this yourselves. And I love it because the parent actually dubs in the child's language so that I don't even have to struggle to understand what the kid's saying. And the kid is doing a beautiful thing here, right? What is he doing? He's using fists and words. How effective, right? You remember the last time I hit you, right? He's actually using language. He's not quite at the place that we would like in terms of his language. We would like him to say, "It's my turn to use the red car," or "No, be my guest. You use the red car, I'll use it later." But he is actually starting to use language instead of only using fists. So we can see he is using sort of partial inhibitory control, not as much as we would like. What's really interesting is he's also drawing on memory, right? On recall, you remember, right? We often ask children to remember. We often ask kids to use their working memory. So what's a good example in a preschool? I know I've been in preschools where teachers will say, "Okay, everybody, it's almost time for recess. I want you to close your books, go to your cubbies, get your shoes, put on your jackets, and get in line," right? Seven things just listed. And the child must recall each of those items of the things that the teacher just asked that the child did. And teachers who are more veteran are probably going to tap that teacher on the shoulder and say, "Only one thing at a time," right? First, close your books, allow the child to complete that task, praise the child for completing that task, and then the next task, right? So that idea that we don't want to burden too heavily the working memory so that we can actually get kids to succeed. That said, expanding working memory often includes trying to do it a lot, right? So concentration is a perfect example. We lay out all the cards, kids are flipping over those cards and tries to making the match, and we know that that task is hard for kids and stretches their skill set, right? Helps them to develop working memory. So why am I dwelling on this? These two things we often think of in the tradition of executive function, this idea of how children use executive cognitive control to manage the world around them, like an air traffic controller, or like an executive trying to make a good decision when lots of information is coming in at the same time. That's the idea of what your prefrontal cortex is doing when Clancy's talking about executive function, really working on inhibitory control, really working on working memory, and really working on attention. And I think one good way of giving a good example of this is by doing a task called the Hearts and Flowers task. So to do this task, I want everybody to get out your Xbox Game Boy controllers, right? I want two thumbs, right? Your left one and your right one. Everybody good? Okay. So we're going to play a little game. This is a standard computer task that we use to assess children's executive function, both adults' executive function and children's executive function. So everybody push the same side that I'm pushing. I'm seeing lots of people pushing that side. Okay, everybody push the other side. All right, good. I'm seeing plenty of thumbs. I'm seeing a few skeptics, but I'm seeing mostly engaged players. Okay, so each time you see a heart, I want you to press the thumb or the forefinger on the same side as the stimulus. For example, if the heart appears on the left, press with your left hand. Okay, I'm doing my right, so you can do your left. Remember, press on the same side as the heart. Good, everybody cool with that? Not too hard, right? You have to focus, but you could do that. Okay, now you're gonna see a flower. We're gonna play the incongruent game. Now this time you're gonna press on the side opposite the flower. For example, if a flower appears on the left, what are you gonna do? Right, good. Here you'll need to inhibit on every trial the natural tendency to respond on the same side as the stimulus. Remember, press on the side opposite the flower. Good, everybody's good with that, right? Clear directions, you all were able to do it. Here we go, now we're gonna play the mixed game. You'll sometimes see a heart, you'll sometimes see a flower. On only half the trials, you have to inhibit the tendency to press on the same side. You'll have to switch between the same side and opposite side rules. The rules stay the same. For hearts, what are you going to press?
Same
side. For flowers, you're going to press?
Opposite.
Awesome. Hearts, same side. Flowers, opposite. Here we go. All right. Good job. Round of applause. Great. What did that do? Who felt a little bit like, ah? All right. Why did you feel that feeling? Pressure, the pressure. Beautiful, beautiful example of what Dr. Blair was just talking, right? Moderate amount of stress, right? You had to actually focus more. You had to actually be more engaged, right? A little anxiety provoking. Now, imagine if you felt that a lot, right? You might actually feel fatigued or stressed out or actually disenchanted with the task. You might start not liking me, you might start not liking being here, right? That you might actually feel a substantial decrement in your performance, right? So moderate stress is not a bad thing. Now, what were the things that you had to draw on to be able to do well at that task? Memory, right? You had to remember what the rules were. What else? Eye-hand coordination, absolutely. But also, you had to focus, right? Attention. You really had to use attention. So memory, attention, and what's that last thing? Inhibit. You had to inhibit that impulse, right? I got you all trained up so that you were ready to do it on the same side when you saw the heart, so that when you had it on the opposite side, you were like, ooh, right? That inhibitory control was a real challenge. That's what your little guys are facing when they are experiencing conflict with a peer. Right? That's what they're experiencing when you tell them that it's time to line up, but they are really engaged in that play space and they do not want to actually put away those blocks. That inhibitory control is really challenging. That's really what's going on with your third graders, your fifth graders, and your seventh graders when they are feeling very, very stressed out and very anxious and they're in the middle of a test-taking situation and they have to actually apply themselves to the problem rather than giving up, like my own seventh grader, and playing on Minecraft, right? It's much easier at that moment to actually kind of take the pressure off instead of pressing forward, right? So using that inhibitory control to suppress that predominant impulse and to do what's expected or do what's demanded is sometimes really challenging. And it gets really challenging when we're experiencing emotional duress, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay, so here we are. This is the brain again, the prefrontal cortex. And what's really important is what Clancy was saying before is that inside, deep in the old, you know, sort of ancient brain, is the limbic system, the part of the brain that's really responsible for emotion. And the way that we think about that is that cognitive processing can really serve as a good executive, right? We can select a good behavioral option in the face of conflicting or emotionally upsetting demands. So you can think, oh, I'm going to use words instead of fists as a preschooler. You're using executive processes to regulate your emotions, right? That top-down process that Clancy Blair was just discussing. But we also know that emotions can also disrupt cognitive functioning, right? The frazzled brain, we know, works less well than the contemplative brain. When that child is upset in a test-taking situation, he or she is going to have less access to strong working memory, less access to inhibitory control, less access even to attention, right? Think about ourselves. I know for me, heading out the door in the morning when I'm frustrated, when I can't get everybody organized and I can't get out that door and I'm feeling a little bit stressed out, it's harder to find my keys, right? It's harder to remember to not start, bickering. Those emotions are actually regulatory. Do these skills matter for learning? We think absolutely that they do. How do we think so? Well, specifically, children who demonstrate better emotional control are liked better by teachers and peers, and in turn, enjoy school more. And that's what's really interesting, is that they not only report liking school more, they actually show up to school more. So they're actually absent less, they are more engaged when they are at school. Then they're emotionally negative peers. Why? It's tough being the kid who's always the loudmouth, difficult kid in the classroom, right? We have empathy for that kid, even though that kid may be the kid that drives us a little bit crazy sometimes. And that kid actually may experience school as a less positive place than a more emotionally well-regulated kid. Specifically, kids who organize attention and use working memory and inhibitory control, this idea of executive function, they actually demonstrate higher achievement even after controlling for IQ. What's great is that that was the most important paper written, I think, in that last 7 or 8 years was Clancy Blair and Rachel Ross's paper that showed that, that helped the field understand we actually don't think such a big deal is made anymore of IQ. It's really executive function. It's what kids do with their cognitive resources in these situations that really leads to them being able to perform well in school, not whether they come in with a high test score at the beginning of the school year or not. So if anybody's interested in that scientific research, that's a really great paper, Blair and Raza, 2007. So specifically, what does that mean for kids in low-income situations? Well, you know, in No Child Left Behind, in the Bush administration, there was a strong emphasis that we, as teachers, get out there and just teach more. And I think while that may have some value, it didn't really take into account the extent to which kids who face cumulative poverty-related stressors are at much higher emotional and behavioral risk. So when Kyle very kindly gave that nice introduction and referred to that paper that I wrote 10 years ago, that's what that paper was saying. We can't expect teachers to just get into that classroom and lift everybody through instructional methods unless we take into account also that low-income kids are facing a lot more emotional and behavioral difficulty because they're facing a lot more of the risk factors that lead to higher risk or preponderance of or probability of having behavioral emotional difficulty. A classic example is that in Head Start classrooms, a really good data that a friend of ours, Janice Cooperschmidt, showed in the early 2000s, that 16% of kids in Head Start classrooms were exhibiting disruptive and unsafe behaviors every day. That's not one kid in a classroom, but two or three kids in a classroom, right? Definitely more kids than teachers may find that they have the emotional resources to handle on a very active level. Specifically also, kids might be having a difficulty on their own learning, but also might be really having difficulty in terms of disrupting other kids' learning. So we wanted really to focus on kids' emotional and behavioral development, not just their academic skills, in order to think about supporting learning over the long haul. So I'm going to tell you about a series of research experiments, actually, where kids or classrooms are randomly assigned through a lottery process to receiving one kind of curriculum or another. And I get a lot of questions from practitioners and policymakers and from my colleagues in science saying, why should you do experiments in preschools? Shouldn't we just go ahead and let all preschools use really good services? Absolutely, but we don't actually always know which the good services are, right? So for those of you administrators, how many of you have recently received a flyer or some kind of call from some kind of salesperson telling you about a new curriculum in the last year? Play. Great. And often it's hard to tell whether that's a good curriculum that's going to actually be wise for you to purchase, or whether that's a curriculum that might actually be more trouble than it's worth. Not just in terms of fiscal trouble, not in terms of just cost, but in terms of your staff time, your staff development time, etc. Right? The thing that we hear from preschool teachers often is, if this is another one of those new interventions that I have to implement, it better work, because I don't want to have to spend a whole year learning your new curriculum if it doesn't work, right? So, in come people like us, researchers, who say, we're actually going to tell you whether the program works by randomly assigning you to either the new thing or the regular thing that you've been doing for a while, to see whether the new thing actually generates new and better improvement in your classroom or in terms of your kids' performance. And that's what we call a randomized control trial, or a field experiment. So what do? We do these kinds of experiments, and it tells us a ton about developmental science. So it tells us whether this new program affects kids' self-regulation, and whether self-regulation, in turn, affects kids' learning. And it also tells us whether this is not just a right developmental pathway, but whether this investment is a wide one. Does this program really make a difference? Does it really make sense for us to start saying that it's a good thing for you to take on? In doing that, we conducted an experiment with 18 preschools in Chicago, and what's just important for you to know is that this was in the neighborhoods outside of the city center. Anybody here from Chicago? Great, so you all recognize this map, right? These neighborhoods on the west side and the south side, on the sort of periphery, the circle, this little ring, are the neighborhoods that have the highest proportions of very low-income kids. Much neighborhoods that are rapidly gentrifying in some cases, and in others, not so much. So we were specifically able to do a block-by-block survey of all of these neighborhoods, and then to find out which preschools wanted to participate, Head Start funded, and we randomly assigned them to a new intervention that targeted kids' self-regulation, or we offered the classrooms a teacher's assistant to try to give them additional support, but in a way that wasn't a curricular support. As you can see, it involved a huge number of collaborators. Just as Clancy pointed out to all of his collaborators, it's important for you all to know how much this is a real huge collaborative effort that I'm honored to be able to present. And we just wanted to know, did this program improve kids' school readiness when they were randomized to treatment or to control? Did we see changes in classroom quality? And did we see changes in kids' behavior problems, self-regulation, and pre-academic skills? And the intervention was multi-component, so it included teacher training and coaching in the fall, some stress reduction for teachers in the winter, and then a one-on-one level of support with mental health consultants providing services to kids with highest emotional behavioral problems. That's what EBP means. And I'm just going to show you the data on kids' executive function, self-regulation, and school readiness. What we did was we embedded direct assessments of children's self-regulation within a standardized battery that also included vocabulary, letter naming, and math. Does anybody remember the NRS, the National Reporting System, where you had to assess all of those kids' vocabulary? We piggybacked on that, and actually Clancy was one of the key figures in that whole effort to try to get both socio-emotional and cognitive measures into that huge battery. Specifically, we just used that opportunity to directly assess kids on their skills. Specifically. So here you see our findings, which are pretty cool. We got really, these are the differences between treatment and control groups, and you can see we got a big significant bar that shows the gain in kids' executive function. We got it in the right direction, but not statistically significant for effortful control, and a big gain in how our assessors reported kids' attention and impulsivity. But what was the real kicker was we got not only these gains, but we also got gains in kids' vocabulary, letter naming, and math skills by only intervening on that self-regulation with that teacher training. We did not give teachers additional reading and or early literacy skill support. We just gave teachers support on how to help your kids with their emotions and their behavior so that your classroom is more well-managed and more emotionally positive. And these were the gains that we got in those treatment classrooms relative to the control classrooms. What's nice is that I then had a colleague who replicated this. I was really proud of my 18 sites, and she said, that's a pilot. I was heartbroken. She said, we're going to pilot it again. We're going to run it in a full-scale trial with 50 sites, and then again with 20 more sites in Chicago, so over 100 sites. And across all of those replications, mixed findings back and forth, but basically the news is good, which is that significant impact on improved classroom management and decreases in classroom negative climate and a significant gain in terms of kids' task orientation and behavioral self-control. Okay, so what does that tell you? Experiments aren't just about researchers trying to get data so that they can get tenure and so that they can learn more about child development, right? Experiments are really deeply about what are the actual tools that classrooms and teachers can use that will really yield to benefit if they're implemented, quote unquote, with fidelity, if they're actually really put into practice by teachers. What does that mean? That teachers need to be given the space to actually implement the tools that they're given, and they need the support from their mid-level administrators and senior administrators to learn those new school tools and to be able to implement them fairly. So with that, we do believe, science is showing us clear evidence, we never say the word proof, but showing us clear evidence that using curricula like these can make a really big difference in very low-income kids' school readiness. What I want to highlight as I move next, I think I've got what? Excellent. Is that we got to also not forget the context that preschools, both the teachers and the kids, are in. So in Chicago, one of the hugest issues that our preschools are in is that communities are facing very high levels of local neighborhood violence. And even though our intervention showed significant gains for the kids in our intervention, we also found that over the course of time, those gains faded quite quickly. Why did they fade quite quickly? Well, we have a lot of clues. One of them is that kids were exposed to very high levels of local violence, very high levels of homicide, assault, robbery, etc., in the households in their same block. And when we actually looked at that with the data that we had, we found that when kids had a homicide that occurred within 1,000 feet of their homes, we didn't find any difference on their executive function or effort control measures, but we did find big differences. The kids who had been exposed to a homicide within 1,000 feet of their homes showed significantly lower attention and impulse control than those same kids had when there hadn't been a crime, and to other kids who lived on basically the same block but outside of the 1,000-foot radius, right? Those exposures to violence were very disruptive in short terms to kids' attention and impulsivity. I see one person shaking her head saying, not true or scary. Yeah, it is amazing to be able to find data that show this so closely and clearly. We've showed this to the city educators in the city of Chicago, and they've immediately said, we need to show this to our community policing colleagues in the office of, basically in the police force, because community policing, therefore, is an educational policy lever. We don't think of it, but it's important for us to recognize communities that are facing high crime and high violence are under extreme duress in terms of kids' physiology, in terms of kids' executive function. What does it also mean? It also means we have to think about kids' schooling. So one of our biggest claims was that we were going to help kids gain these self-regulation skills in preschool, and they were going to carry them, you know, like little backpacks into their kindergartens, right? That they were going to move from our preschools, the ones that we worked so hard to collaborate with, into those bigger school settings. What we found was we don't know that much about low-income children's executive function and self-regulation as they make this big transition. It's this whole new area of research that we're really relatively under-informed about. And when we started to think about that, we realized that urban public schools can be exceptionally stressful places for many kids. We specifically were able to use a student connection survey where older middle school kids in the same school buildings rated their schools. So we followed our little preschool kids as they went from 18 preschools to over 200 schools. And we found out about those 200 schools using this student connection survey where the middle schoolers were rating those schools. And we found that in those schools, as of 2009, 17% of the kids in those middle schoolers in those school buildings reported that they didn't feel physically safe, that they did not feel emotionally safe, they were often teased, bullied, or harassed. And those kids didn't want to basically be in those schools. They wanted to stay home, change schools, or basically get somebody to help because those schools did not feel safe. So what does that mean? That preschool teachers have to work with administrators within the larger school context to let them know and to really collectively work on school climate, what we call school climate, as a full school level variable, not just what's going on in the classroom. Now, probably everybody in this room knows that, but for those of us who do a lot of schools research, we tend to get insanely focused on what's going on in the classroom, what's going on in the classroom, what's being implemented in the classroom. And this helps us to understand and remember we have to focus on the school as a dynamic ecological setting, not just the classroom. So lastly, I just want to talk about teachers. Our study has illustrated that teachers are also undergoing a great deal of stress, facing challenges themselves. So specifically, preschool teachers were definitely facing their own financial and economic strains of trying to make ends meet on a teacher salary. Two-thirds of our own teachers were single parents raising kids on a teacher salary. They were also facing violence in school and neighborhoods, and they were also facing what a lot of people have talked about as compassion fatigue. They were feeling pretty burnt out by trying to meet the emotional needs of their kids. Not to say that they didn't love their kids and were deeply supportive of their kids, but they themselves were experiencing a lot of strain on that. And what we did was we really put in that middle portion of our training to help teachers manage their own feelings of stress. Because guess what? That Yerkes Dodson Dodson curve that's true for kids is also true for adults, right? Adults at high levels of stress are also having a hard time remembering their own rules about how to interact with kids, how to modulate their feelings of frustration when that little kid is banging on the blackboard for the 15th time, right? That is difficult and stressful. When a parent or a teacher is feeling emotionally relatively on even keel, but becomes even more difficult when a teacher is feeling stressed out. So when we did focus on teacher stress, we found that it was a key foundation for motivating teachers to be engaged in intervention where they were expected to provide emotional support. It was actually linked clearly to how much teachers implemented the intervention. When we focused on caring about teachers, teachers focused on caring about the intervention. We're very much more likely to implement the intervention. And intervention substantially increased teachers' feelings of job control and resources in the classroom. They felt better about their jobs as teacher. It definitely improved the classroom climate as observed by outside independent observers. And interestingly and frustratingly, it actually decreased teachers' confidence. Why? Because teachers had to take a step back and say, oh, wow, there's a mental health consultant in my classroom giving me feedback about what I could do to improve my classroom, what I could do to support kids' emotional development. Maybe some of the things that I've been doing aren't actually the best things that I could be doing. That actually reduced or lowered teachers' confidence in the short term. We hope that they gained skills and that they were more confident in the long term, but it was important for us to be sanguine and clear. This is actually a non-trivial expectation that we're giving teachers when we put these experts in the classroom to help them implement these new interventions. So how can we support kids' self-regulation in multiple contexts? I've talked a lot about how we have to think outside the classroom as well as within the classroom, specifically really thinking both about executive function and emotion reg in the classroom in terms of school socio-emotional learning, but also in the school. One example has been a lot of work that colleagues of ours, Mark Greenberg and Tish Jennings, have been doing on mindfulness, how to really help teachers modulate their own levels of stress. And then to think about how we've undervalued or undercapitalized opportunities outside the classroom like childcare or after school. I don't know about your community, but I know in our community, after school is an area where there's relatively low amounts of teacher training, low amounts of teacher support, low amounts of oversight in terms of fidelity of implementation of good interventions, right? Seems like a great area, a great place to be able to capture and support kids' emotion regulation in not too structured ways, because kids need to blow off some steam too. So some interesting examples, just I thought you might be interested. There are some schools that are taking a whole school-wide process of planning, implementation, and evaluation of transforming the school climate. There's a lot going on in terms of packaged modules for ways to build ES. I think Clancy talked about how hot executive function is right now. Some of those you have to really look at kind of with a grain of salt to see, is this actually evidence-based? Does this actually make sense? Lots of trainings to improve classroom management, which I think CSRP kind of falls into. And then lots that are actually a lot more thoughtful and intelligent, frankly, than the one that I designed, which is specifically Deb Leon's Elena Budrova's on Tools of the Mind, is much more comprehensive than simply getting a better classroom climate. And she'll talk about that in a minute. A good example for older kids, for example, is this thing called 4Rs, where kids learn to use words to communicate feelings. They learn simple techniques to take a break when upset. And a lot of randomized controlled trials are suggesting these benefits. If you're curious about these, Science Magazine last year, for example, had a whole section on interventions that have been shown to support kids' executive function that I recommend. Just as an example of how to test out whether a curriculum makes sense, you want to check to see, does it know what domain it's actually affecting? Is it affecting emotion regulation, cognitive regulation, both cognitive and social and self-regulation? What is the point of these different modules that we're doing? Do they explain those concepts clearly so that teachers know what it is that they're being asked to focus on? And does it have really clear tasks and activities that make sense and that have very specific outcomes for what is expected of kids? In all of these cases, you just want to think a lot about whether the intervention makes developmental sense. Does it have theory that supports it, that makes sense? It's not like a hodgepodge of 15,000 things, but actually it has one coherent developmental story that it's telling. Is it evidence-based? Is there any support, research support to back it up? Tools of the Mind, for example, has had a lot of excellent research support to support it. And is it designed to fit within existing programmatic expectations and demands? Can teachers actually use this within the expectations of their programs as they're currently being asked to do a lot else? That's what I really wanted to talk about in terms of CSRP, and I think this is a really good transition to move to Dr. Leon's presentation about Tools of the Mind. Thank you.